Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight on pause. Injections of the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine are halted across much of the country following several cases of blood clots. Then Minnesota on edge. Another night of unrest follows the police killing of Daunte Wright as lawyers launch their defense of former officer Derek Chauvin in the George Floyd murder case. And going solar, a small Florida community aims for energy independence by harnessing the power of the sun.
It just makes sense to do it the right way, to live in an environment that is clean and sustainable. That's just good for us health-wise. So if we are also helping in climate change, we're all winning.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. On this day, with several big news developments, including the aftermath of another police killing in Minnesota and President Biden's announcement of when U.S. troops will leave Afghanistan, we begin with the COVID story. A number of vaccination centers have begun suspending the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine after federal health officials recommended the move. The Centers for Disease Control and the FDA said today that they are reviewing extremely rare and severe blood clots in six women. That is out of nearly 7 million people who have received the vaccine in the U.S. Dr. Ann Schuchat is the principal deputy director of the CDC, and she joins us now. And for the record, Johnson & Johnson is a NewsHour funder. Dr. Schuchat, welcome back to the NewsHour. What can you tell us about these blood clots and how dangerous they are?
Thank you, Judy. We're taking this very seriously. As you said, almost 7 million doses of the J&J vaccine have been administered in the United States. And right now, we have six reports of serious blood clots, including one fatality, unfortunately. There's an unusual pattern to the blood clots in that there's a very low platelet count in addition to the clotting event. And that unusual pattern tipped us off that we really needed to take this seriously. We've recommended a pause for three reasons, because we wanted to give the healthcare community time to learn how to recognize, diagnose, and manage this condition. Because if you treat this condition with the usual treatment for clotting, it can get worse. So that was a critical reason to get the word out. The second one was to urge more reporting so we could get a better understanding of the pattern and whether this is limited to women, certain ages, or just how frequent it is. And then the third reason for the pause was to give time for our Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, our group of independent scientific experts, to review the data carefully and give us their advice. And that meeting will be happening tomorrow.
Dr. Schuchat, is it certain that there are only, not only, but there are six women and there are no more people who've developed these clots?
We don't know that yet. We are actively urging reporting, both by clinicians and by patients or their families, through the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS, which is how we detected these cases. So we are very interested in understanding whether there are additional cases or possible cases, and it takes a bit of time to validate, to review the records and so forth. These are a rare set of symptoms, not the usual kind of blood clots or strokes that people see, and it's unusual enough that we really want to get to the bottom of it.
And I'm asking about the number because sometimes the reporting may be delayed, and 6 out of 7 million is such a small number. I think people want to be reassured that it is that small.
Yeah, that's right. This is an extremely rare event that we're tracking right now. But because the usual treatment for people presenting with this rare event is different than what clinicians might think of, we wanted to take a pause and give time for clinicians to get up to speed on this. In fact, we'll be doing a call for a broad group of clinicians on Thursday to try to help them learn how to recognize, manage, and respond. But you're right, this is extremely rare right now based on what we know. And we have to learn more, but I just want to say how important it is to the CDC, the FDA, and the federal government for us to take vaccine safety seriously. We know that we are vaccinating on average of over 3 million people a day, mostly with the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, and those vaccines are proving to be very safe and effective, and we haven't seen this problem of the low platelet count and the blood clots with those other two vaccines. But with this J&J vaccine, we want to keep our eye on it and have this pause while we take time to learn about whether there are more cases and whether they really are linked to the vaccine.
We know there was investigation. There was a lengthy process before the FDA approved the J&J vaccine for emergency authorized use. Why wasn't this discovered then?
There are a couple things to say. First off, when we have retrospectively looked back at the clinical trials, there was one episode of an event that looks a lot like this. It was actually in a man. And at the time, a single episode, it's very difficult to understand what that might be. But of course, we've been actively monitoring the safety as the vaccines get given out more broadly. But you can imagine when you have an event that might be as rare as one in a million, that may not show up in a clinical trial, even as large as the trials were before the FDA authorization. And that's why we take very seriously monitoring safety as well as effectiveness after vaccines go into large-scale use, because you really can't detect something very rare in vaccine trials, even with 50 or 60,000 patients.
And finally, how long do you think this pause may last, and what's the effect on the availability of vaccines overall to Americans?
Well, the good news is that there's a supply of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, and we expect not to see a challenge with supply in the short-term future based on this. In fact, we're expecting 28 million doses of those other two vaccines for this next week. I can't say exactly how long the pause will go on. I can say that we're working very quickly to get as much information as we can, and we're holding that first advisory committee on immunization practices emergency meeting tomorrow. We'll know more after that, and I commit that we're going to get back and update the American public about this as we know more.
Well, I know everybody's paying very close attention. Dr. Anne Schuchat, who is the principal deputy director of the CDC. Dr. Schuchat, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Judy.
The death of George Floyd and the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin has kept the state of Minnesota in the national spotlight. Now, the death of Daunte Wright near Minneapolis has led to new protests and reopened longstanding questions over policing and race. Special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro has our report and a warning. Viewers may find some images disturbing.
With calls for accountability growing louder in the Minneapolis suburb, the police officer who fatally shot 20-year-old Daunte Wright resigned today.
I'm hoping that this will help bring some calm to the community.
The officer was identified as Kim Potter, a 26-year veteran of the Brooklyn Center Police Force. The city's police chief, Tim Gannon, who also resigned today, had earlier described the killing at a traffic stop on Sunday as, quote, an accidental discharge, and said the officer had meant to draw her taser. The father of Daunte Wright, Aubrey Wright, said in an interview today that he rejects that explanation.
I lost my son. He's never coming back. I can't accept that. A mistake, that doesn't even sound right.
Cries for justice are reverberating across the community, reeling after nights of protest.
I actually pray for Mr. Wright's mom because I know what she's going through because I lost my son, you know, so he was murdered, you know, so I know exactly her pain and what she's going through.
I'm concerned, I'm scared. We don't know what's about to occur. A life has been taken.
Say his name!
Frustration over the city's handling was felt at a vigil for Wright last night, marked by emotional moments. Hundreds then took to the streets for a new round of protests outside the police station. Lines of officers in riot gear kept watch as anger built through the night, hours past curfew.
You just killed Dante Wright, and y'all made a mistake, and y'all gonna kill me too?
Looters broke into and vandalized a Dollar Tree nearby, while others set off fireworks outside. Police began firing flashbang grenades and tear gas to disperse them. The Minnesota State Patrol said about 40 people were arrested.
As business owners in Brooklyn Center board up their windows and doors, bracing for perhaps one more night of unrest, almost everyone here has an eye also on goings-on in downtown Minneapolis, where the trial of Derek Chauvin entered its 12th day of testimony today.
The death of George Floyd at the hands of police continues gripping the nation.
Your Honor, the state of Minnesota rests.
Thank you.
Today, prosecutors for the state of Minnesota wrapped up their case. And Chauvin's attorney, Eric Nelson, kicked off the defense, highlighting an incident involving Mr. Floyd and law enforcement on May 6, 2019, about a year before he died. Nelson called retired paramedic Michelle Mosing, who treated Floyd on that day.
Were you able to learn that Mr. Floyd had consumed some narcotics that day?
Yes. He told me that he had been taking multiple, like every 20 minutes. I don't remember if it was Oxy or Percocet, but it was a opioid-based.
Retired Minneapolis police officer Scott Creighton, who arrested Mr. Floyd in the 2019 incident, also took the stand.
Did you see the passenger do anything physically with his hands?
Yes, he turned away from me towards the driver's seat as continually as I was giving him commands to see his hands.
But throughout the day, the prosecution took several opportunities to cross-examine.
You were interacting with Mr. Floyd, correct?
Yes.
And while you were interacting with Mr. Floyd, he didn't collapse on the ground, correct?
No, he did not.
And Mr. Floyd didn't drop dead while you were interacting with him, correct?
No.
The defense brought Minneapolis Park Police Officer Peter Chang to the stand. Chang was the fifth officer to arrive on the scene May 25th, 2020, the day Mr. Floyd died.
Did you notice any changes in the area?
There was a crowd, and yes, the crowd was becoming more loud and aggressive, a lot of yelling across the street.
Did that cause you any concern?
Concern for the officer's safety, yes.
Hoping to sow doubt about Chauvin's culpability, the defense honed in on its arguments that a hostile crowd distracted officers and that health factors like a pre-existing condition or drug use led to Floyd's death. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro.
Yamiche Alcindor has reaction now from two people directly involved in both of these cases.
Judy, the killings of Dante Wright and George Floyd continue to reverberate not only in Minnesota, but around the country when it comes to policing, use of force, and race. Our next two guests are personally involved with all of this. Polonius Floyd is George Floyd's younger brother, and he took the witness stand yesterday. Benjamin Crump is an attorney representing the Floyd family and Dante Wright's mother. Thank you both so much for being here. Polonius, I want to start with you. You took the stand yesterday. What was that experience like for you, and what's been the hardest part of the last 24 hours?
Just taking the stand, it was pretty much like a relief to me because the narrative was already painted that they wanted to say that my brother was this, he was that, and he was the one that was tortured to death on camera. He was the one that I had to see over and over again murdered on camera. So when I had the opportunity to be able to speak about my brother, the things that he shared with us, how he would interact with our mom, it was a blessing, especially when I think about how he used to pick her up when she became handicapped and he used to dance with her and they used to let Al Green play Love and Happiness. It made me melt when I watched them because it was just so unique watching them dance and things like that, the interactions that they had. And for the last 24 hours, I've just been kind of excited, but at the same time, I've been down because I think about what's going on with Dante and his family, how they're grieving. And I wouldn't want that on any other family. That's why I stand and I support them now.
You talk about Dante Wright, and I want to ask you about him in a minute, but convicting officers is very, very rare in this country. What do you make of how the trial has gone, and how confident are you in this system of justice?
You know, I'm confident in what we see, what the world witnessed. The world seen my brother's life extinguished in front of all. And I am confident that these officers, they will be convicted, because you have too many protesters all around the world marching nationwide, and everybody is yelling, "I can't breathe," over and over and over again, because people want to see change. They want to see justice, because what happened in that video was wrong. And these police officers, they have to be held accountable, or this will continue to happen over and over again. And you will see Mr. Crump everywhere, all across the world, trying to help these families grieve and get through this process that we shouldn't have.
And Ben, you've been all across the world representing different families. What do you make of the cases presented by the prosecution and the defense? And how much faith do you have that the system this time may deliver justice for your clients?
Well, I believe Keith Ellison, the attorney general, the first African-American attorney general of the state of Minnesota, who has a track record as a champion in civil rights, he and his prosecutors are making a very compelling case that Derek Chauvin should be held criminally liable for the killing of George Perry Floyd. But despite what I may think, Philonis Floyd's optimism and his faith is rubbing off on me. And so I do believe in my heart that based on this video that has been seen 50 million times on the internet alone, that in my heart, we're going to get a conviction. But America has broken my heart in the past.
There are a lot of people who are feeling heartbroken. Felonious, I want to ask you, Philando Castile was killed before your brother in Minnesota. Now we have Dante Wright killed during this trial for this officer. What do you make of this latest killing of Dante? And how is it making you possibly relive your own trauma?
Oh, man. it was terrible. I woke up in the morning to find out that a young African-American child had passed away. He was still a kid. You know, he didn't come from a broken family. He had a mom, he had a dad, he had everything that you can imagine that a lot of kids grow up in the African-American community we don't have. And just to see how that mom was grieving, it was devastating watching her. It was devastating watching the auntie. She really showed what these families are going through, because a lot of these people that you meet, they don't know how to process this information. They don't know how to talk about what's going on. And she was just outspoken, and she was just letting you know who he was, and he still should be here. Just like his name is Dante Wright, he should still be right here, right now, like his last name. Hmm. And unfortunately, we have to go through this trauma, and the world is going through this traumatic stage again, but we have to stand with Dante and his family.
And Ben Crump, I want to come to you. You're representing the family of Dante Wright, his mother. What can you tell us about that case, whether or not the officer is going to be charged? And what do you make of the fact that this is, of course, happening during this trial?
I believe that the police officer will be charged with some level of manslaughter when they look at all the evidence, the fact that she was a 26-year police veteran and that she was training people on that day. And there's a lot of suspicions, and they're looking into whether or not they even should have been stopping people for expired license tags, because the DMV had been shut down and backlogged since COVID-19 pandemic. And so there was a directive sent out that don't be stopping people for having expired tags, because it may be they haven't been able to get an appointment with the DMV. And so I say that to say, it seems like even for minor traffic events, Black people end up dead in some of the most unusual, bizarre ways. I mean, think about George Floyd Filonis' brother, the alleged $20 counterfeit bill. That's a misdemeanor. He could have been given a ticket. They had the discretion to do that. But when it's Black people in America, they always engage in doing the most, the most infuriating manner to use excessive force against us. I just see George over the $20. I think about the sergeant in Virginia who was putting his hands out the window, being very reasonable. And then I think about Dante, this young man who probably was not making the best decision, but he didn't put them in harm's way. He was trying to get away from them on a traffic citation, and they shoot and kill him right in the midst of the Derek Chauvin trial regarding George Floyd's killing, which I believe is the seminal civil rights case in policing in America's history, that you will have a police officer kill a young man, an unarmed young man, within 10 miles from where the courthouse.
And Ben Crum, sticking with you, we've talked about Black people and policing for a long, long time. What's the disconnect here?
It is about implicit bias. They don't give marginalized minorities the benefit of consideration and professionalism when they pull us. And that's why you see them doing the most versus trying to use their discretion to de-escalate matters. They de-escalated just fine on January 6, 2021, when the white nationalists stormed the Capitol. And so it's not that they can't de-escalate. It's not that they're trained. I believe it's implicit bias training that they don't respect Black people in America enough to make sure we get the benefit of our constitutional rights.
Well, thank you so much, Filonis Floyd. Condolences to your family. I'm so sorry for your loss. Thanks for joining us. Benjamin Crump, attorney, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
President Biden plans to announce tomorrow that all 2,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan will leave by September 11th. The NewsHour confirmed the decision today. It is 4 months later than the previous deadline. Top Republicans immediately criticized the move. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell called it, quote, a grave mistake. Here with some background on the decision is our Amna Nawaz. So, Amna, fill us in on what we know about this decision.
Judy, it's a huge announcement from the White House in America's longest war. As you mentioned, President Biden now plans to begin withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan starting next month with an eye to having all U.S. troops out by September 11th. Now, we should point out the Biden administration essentially inherited an exit plan from the Trump administration. That was a deal they negotiated with the Taliban last year. The Taliban said, we will stop attacking U.S. troops, we will cut ties with al-Qaeda, and the U.S. said we'll be out by May 1st. Now, President Biden came in and said that deadline was going to be very hard to meet. There's anywhere from about 2,500 to 3,500 U.S. troops on the ground right now in Afghanistan. That number does fluctuate. That's why they've been working to develop their own plan. Now, we do expect, as you mentioned, more details tomorrow. But for now, this is a very big announcement. It's 20 years after the attacks that led the U.S. to launch that war in the first place. Trillions of dollars later, more than 2,000 U.S. troops dead, over 100,000 Afghan civilians dead. And Judy, now we know that the U.S. says they'll be done fighting this fall.
And Amna, we know when this war began, there was broad bipartisan support for the United States going in. Tell us more about what the reaction's been this afternoon.
Yeah, Judy, you mentioned some of it. We've heard from Mitch McConnell already criticizing the plan, calling it a grave mistake. Others, like Chuck Schumer, have said they want to be briefed on it. They're going to wait and see and have some more details. But some, like Senator Tim Kaine, have basically said, we support this plan because it's time. It's been long enough, and it's time for the U.S. to leave. And a White House senior official who briefed some reporters today made basically the same argument. They said the mission in Afghanistan was twofold. One, deliver justice for 9/11, and two, disrupt the terror networks there. And Osama bin Laden is dead, and the al-Qaeda threat and the threat to the U.S. is largely gone. But we should point out the threat has not gone away. When you look at the Taliban today, they are stronger than ever. They have been resurgent since the drawdown of peak U.S. forces in 2011. And today, they control or contest more territory across Afghanistan than at any other time in recent history. And that is why the U.S. is negotiating with them about an exit plan and not with the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani. Now, we should say that the Taliban have stopped attacking U.S. forces, but they're attacking more Afghan forces and Afghan civilians. So there has been an increase in violence. The concern is they're poised now to take over once again. So, Judy, when the U.S. troops leave, when the last of those U.S. troops leave Afghanistan by September 11th of this year, as President Biden says, they'll essentially be handing the keys right back over to the same forces they've been fighting for 20 years. Judy?
A lot of concern. We'll be watching for the president's announcement tomorrow and then, of course, watching to see what happens between now and September and after. Amna, thank you very much.
Thanks, Judy.
In other news, Iran warned that it will be beginning enriching uranium to 60% purity, the highest level yet, but still short of weapons grade. The announcement follows an attack that damaged the Natanz nuclear facility, an attack that Tehran blames on Israel. The Iranian foreign minister insisted today that his government won't be deterred.
I assure you that Natanz will definitely, in the near future, progress with more advanced centrifuges. And if Israel thought they can prevent Iran and the Iranian people from pursuing the lifting of the U.S. sanctions, they've played a very bad gamble.
The warning came hours before informal talks in Vienna on the U.S. rejoining the Iran nuclear accord. The holy month of Ramadan began today in much of the Muslim world amid surging COVID cases and restrictions. In Saudi Arabia, limited numbers of worshipers were allowed inside the Grand Mosque in Mecca for a socially distanced walk around the Kaaba shrine. Egypt banned some traditional events, while Indonesia opened mosques under strict protocols. Back in this country, a slain U.S. Capitol Police officer, William Billy Evans, was honored by the nation's leaders. The 18-year-old veteran died this month when a man rammed his car into him and another officer outside the Capitol. Today, family members, fellow officers, lawmakers, and President Biden gathered in the Capitol Rotunda. The president spoke directly to Evans' widow and two young children.
You're going to make it. By holding each other together, most importantly, by holding Logan and Abigail as tightly as you can. Because as long as you have them, you've got Billy. As long as you have them.
Following the ceremony, Evans lay in honor for the remainder of the afternoon. There are new appeals tonight for the United States to cut greenhouse gas emissions. More than 300 businesses, including Apple, Google, and Coca-Cola, are urging reductions of 50% from 2005 levels by the year 2030. Dozens of European lawmakers, executives, and union leaders made a similar appeal today. President Biden is nominating the first person of color to lead the U.S. Census Bureau. Robert Santos is Mexican-American and currently runs the American Statistical Association. The Census Bureau is now working on data from the 2020 count that will be used in redrawing congressional districts. And on Wall Street, tech stocks were up, but other sectors fell. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 68 points to close at 33,677. The Nasdaq rose 146 points. The S&P 500 added 13 for another new record close. Still to come on the NewsHour, tensions rise as Russia mobilizes troops along its border with Ukraine. A small Florida community works toward energy independence with a massive array of solar panels. A new biography underlines the influence of former First Lady Nancy Reagan, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
After months of simmering conflict, thousands of Russian troops have massed on the border of Ukraine. It is the largest buildup of troops since Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. Amna is back now with that.
Russia-backed separatists have been fighting against Ukrainian forces since 2014. But this year, Ukraine says Russia's gathered nearly 80,000 troops at its border. Russia's deployed troops in Russian-annexed Crimea in the south and along the border with Ukraine's Donbas region in the east. Now, the Russian government says it's a reaction to what it claimed are NATO plans to push troops closer to Russia's borders. During a meeting with his Ukrainian counterpart today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken voiced his support.
The United States stands firmly behind the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine, and I'm here to reaffirm that with the foreign minister today. And that's particularly important at a time when we're seeing, unfortunately, Russia take very provocative actions when it comes to Ukraine.
President Biden also spoke today with Russian President Vladimir Putin to press that message. Joining me now to discuss what all of this means is former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Bill Taylor. Ambassador Taylor, welcome back to the NewsHour, and thank you for making the time. Let me just start with what your understanding is of what's driving this escalation right now, and in particular, Russia's framing of it.
So, Anna, this is a hard question to answer because no one can get inside the head of Mr. Putin. No one understands his motivations. He surprised the world when he invaded his neighbor, as you indicated earlier, in 2014. So it's hard to say. It's clearly not what he put out in terms of NATO pushing toward the Russian border. That's just ludicrous. There may be some concern on Mr. Putin's part that his popularity, his support among Russians is declining, and he needs some way to boost that. He also may be trying to put pressure on Ukraine, and that's clearly happening. Ukraine is standing up to it, as you have indicated. He may also be trying to put some pressure on the new Biden administration, just to put them to a test early on. But as I say, it's hard to see. There's nothing that would have prompted this from the Ukrainian side.
And trying to unpack again why we are at this moment, I wanted to ask you about what we've been seeing inside Ukraine. Has there been actions from President Zelensky there that could also have provoked President Putin to take this kind of escalation right now?
President Zelensky has been pushing back against Russian-oriented Ukrainians, and in particular, Russian-oriented Ukrainian oligarchs. And he has also pushed back and closed down some Russian TV stations, three TV stations that broadcast disinformation from the Kremlin. So he has pushed back. The other thing he has done, the President Zelensky has done, is made it clear his intent, which is in the Ukrainian Constitution, to move toward NATO, toward the European Union, and indeed toward NATO membership. This is troubling, undoubtedly, for the Russians, but this is the sovereign right of a country to make its decisions.
Let me ask you about the U.S. approach to all of this, because for years, Ukraine has had unwavering bipartisan support from the U.S. when it comes to that conflict with Russia. That shifted during the Trump administration, right? Did those 4 years help lead to this moment?
It's a very good question. So it shifted to some degree over the past 4 years, but only at the very top of the U.S. administration. It was only at the very top of the Trump administration where there was any question about the support for Ukraine. The State Department and the Defense Department and the National Security Council and the Congress, as you've indicated, on a bipartisan basis, they continued to support Ukraine. And it was just this weird dichotomy between most of the government and the very top. So, yes, that did confuse people, and that could have left some question in people's mind, whether it was in Ukraine or in Russia, as to how firmly the United States would support. I think the new administration has made it clear that they, as you just indicated, unwaveringly support Ukraine's sovereignty.
So, Ambassador Taylor, we heard Secretary Blinken there say that the U.S. stands with Ukraine. President Biden reiterated that in his call with President Putin. But in your view, how far should that support extend? I mean, should U.S. forces be willing to put their lives on the line for this conflict?
I don't think the Ukrainians are interested in having U.S. forces on, U.S. combat forces on their territory. I'm sure that the indications of support from the United States in terms of naval forces, which are moving toward the Black Sea, in terms of overflights to be able to identify the kinds of movements that the Russians are undertaking right now. The other thing that we should be doing and moving forward is coordinating with our European allies for those increased sanctions. If the Russians know that more severe sanctions are already cooked, are already worked out between the Americans and the Europeans, that could also act as a deterrent. It's the deterring military action that we need to do. It's not with U.S. combat forces. It is with diplomacy. It's with security assistance, and it's with economic threats.
Bill Taylor, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Ambassador Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Florida is no stranger to the damaging effects of climate change. Miles O'Brien visited a community billed as the country's first solar-powered town. It is the latest report in our ongoing coverage about climate change and its consequences, and part of a major journalism collaborative called Covering Climate Now.
It's first light, and one of the largest solar arrays in the Sunshine State is starting another 150 megawatt day.
We spent 8 years working to make this happen.
Developer Sid Kitson showed me the crown jewel of his sustainable town that could signal the dawn of a new era in the fight against the climate change crisis.
It's 700,000 panels on about 800 acres of land. So it is a very large solar field. That's more than enough to power our city at full build out.
It's called Babcock Ranch, the first solar-powered town in the country.
So when you look out here, is this our future?
It is the future. It's a piece of the puzzle, and it's a good piece of the puzzle.
The puzzle pieces are falling into place 25 miles north of Fort Myers at what was a huge cattle ranch. Here, Kitson and partners are developing a master plan community of nearly 20,000 homes with a population of 50,000. So far, about 2,300 are here in 900 homes. And it already feels like a town, with a main street, a green with a bandshell, shops and offices. Nearly all the amenities are planned. It will all eventually be connected by autonomous electric shuttles. For now, golf carts and electric scooters are the preferred means of mobility.
We want them to stay here, to be comfortable here, to have the shopping, to have the entertainment that they want. I want them to be able to work here and obviously live their lives here.
Kitson has been a developer for more than 35 years. Before that, he was a lineman for the Green Bay Packers and Dallas Cowboys in the 80s. Now he hopes to write a new playbook for developers to go on offense against the climate emergency.
When people hear the word developer, it has a certain connotation that might not necessarily be all that positive. It just makes sense to do it the right way, to live in an environment that is clean and sustainable. That's just good for us health-wise. So if we are also helping in climate change, we're all winning.
The utility that built and operates the solar arrays, Florida Power and Light, agrees. It was one of the company's first big forays into solar power.
It's really our showcase working with Babcock Ranch to highlight all the things that we're doing in one spot.
Matt Valley is FPL's vice president of development. Since the installation of these arrays at Babcock Ranch in 2016, the company has gone big on solar power. Statewide, it has installed about 11 million solar panels, generating nearly 9% of what it puts into the grid. The big driver is economics. Solar panels are now 80% cheaper than they were a decade ago.
Every time we make a forecast for what we think solar is going to be in a few years, when we get to that point in time, the actual cost of solar is much lower than we were forecasting. It's the only thing in our generation plan going forward for the next 10 years.
FPL has built 10 megawatts of lithium battery storage here, but it's not nearly enough to power Babcock Ranch through the night. A natural gas plant fills the gap. Grid-level energy storage ideas remain in their infancy, but some Babcock Ranch residents aren't willing to wait for that. They have solar panels on the roof and Tesla battery walls in the garage.
So that at any one time, we're getting electricity either from the batteries, from the roof itself for the solar panels we have up there, or from the grid.
Tom and Lisa Hall have lived here for a year.
I've heard people say, we're living in the city of the future, but we're living here already. Everybody moves here are really pioneers. People feel a certain sense of they're taking part in a real experiment and they're part of it and they love being part of it.
Sid Kitson's definition of sustainability extends far beyond renewable energy. He has worked hard to ensure Babcock Ranch has sustainable demographics, a mix of incomes and ages. And that's why one of the first things he built was this charter school with a project-based learning curriculum.
I walk into these rooms and think, man, these guys are going to be world changers. They truly are.
Shannon Treese is the principal. The school filled up almost instantly and has lured many families with school-age kids to Babcock Ranch.
We want to breed that innovation mindset, that growth mindset, that you're never done learning. And if we're going to solve big world problems, you got to have a skill set to do that.
You're growing sustainable humans, essentially, right?
I hope so. That's the goal.
But is this idea an interesting one-off or something that can be replicated?
I think jury's still out on Babcock Ranch.
Ellen Dunham-Jones is a professor of architecture at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Her research is focused on retrofitting existing suburbs to make them more sustainable. She says Babcock Ranch is a shining example of so-called new urbanist design principles, but
it's not dealing enough with really the bigger challenges that we have to deal with. So it's doing good things, but I want to see the lessons learned from that we can really apply to, I think, this much bigger challenge, which is all the existing places.
And that is happening. She says many developers are transforming dead shopping malls and office parks in the suburbs into more pedestrian-friendly town centers. It's a back-to-the-future approach to development, which Sid Kitson has embraced. The old Babcock Ranch property was 90,000 acres, but his development will sit on only a fifth of it. He sold the rest back to the state to be set aside. And in some cases, he brought the land back to its natural state. This wetland had been drained for agriculture.
You look out here and you look at this beautiful wetland now, knowing that just literally a couple years ago, it was dry, arid, and not good for anything. Now it's flourishing.
A developer who has created some swampland in Florida. Go figure. The land here is 30 feet above sea level. In the state with the most to lose as the climate changes, Babcock Ranch is sitting pretty indeed. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Babcock Ranch, Florida.
During her more than 50-year marriage, Nancy Reagan was also the most trusted advisor to her husband, President Ronald Reagan. Washington Post columnist Karen Tumulty is out with a new book about her and her influence, titled The Triumph of Nancy Reagan. I spoke with Karen yesterday. Karen Tumulty, welcome to the NewsHour. You paint such a vivid portrait of Nancy Reagan. The reader almost feels as if we are living alongside her. Give us a sense of the research, the work that went into this book.
I've been working on this book for 4.5 years. I started out thinking I'd be writing about a first lady, about a marriage, obviously a love story. But the deeper I got into the research, the more I realized that Nancy Reagan is a different window into the entire Reagan presidency, and actually an entire hinge point in our history.
You spend a good amount of time telling us about her family, her mother, her relationship with her stepfather. How did all that shape who she became?
Nancy Reagan was born Anne Frances Robbins and the product of a failed marriage between an ambitious actress and a not very successful car salesman. Her parents essentially split up as soon as she was born, and her mother decides that she is going to continue to pursue her acting career and her busy social life, and essentially abandons Nancy Reagan to live with relatives for the next 6 years. And that really casts a shadow on her spirit that I think lasts for the rest of her life. She is perpetually wary, perpetually anxious, perpetually convinced that no matter how successful she is, no matter how good things are, that life is just a trap door and everything could disappear in an instant. And certainly 2 months after her husband's inauguration, all of that seems to be confirmed when she almost loses him to a would-be assassin's bullet.
You write about their relationship, of course. That's through the entire book, a love story for the ages, but also complicated in that she was a take-no-prisoners, not just supporter of his. She paid attention to every single aspect of his life to make sure it was successful.
This really was a partnership, and I think a partnership without which he would never become governor of California or president. She loves him, she believes in his greatness, but she also is fully aware of his vulnerabilities and his weaknesses. And she has skills that he doesn't. She's shrewder about people. She's warier. She essentially has a better, more fine-tuned radar than he does about the people around him, who is serving their own interests and their own agendas versus who is there for him.
As we look back on it, where did she make the most difference?
She would say, I don't deal with policy. I just deal with people. Well, of course, I mean, Judy, anybody who's been in Washington 5 minutes knows that people issues are policy issues. And I opened the book on something George Shultz told me, which is a moment where she arranges a little dinner for four, the two couples. The whole purpose of the dinner is to get George Shultz away from her husband's hardline hawkish advisors and give him an opportunity to speak to Ronald Reagan directly. And it is at that moment, Shultz told me, that he began to realize that for all of Ronald Reagan's anti-communist rhetoric, despite the fact that he was presiding over the biggest peacetime military buildup in history, this is a guy who actually wants to reach out to the Soviet Union. And certainly Nancy Reagan believed that this should be her husband's place in history as a peacemaker and not a warmonger.
And of course, that's exactly what went on to happen. At the time, we didn't realize it, but she was very, very active behind the scenes.
What people don't realize about Ronald Reagan is that as affable, as amiable as he was, as gifted as he was connecting with the American people, that he was actually a solitary figure. Given his druthers, he'd have been out pounding fence posts on his ranch, and is really Nancy Reagan who builds and cultivates the network around her husband. She was an incredibly valuable ally to those among her husband's advisors who recognized her power, who could get her on board a policy or a position. And people who were not on her good side tended not to last for very long.
She's hardly a feminist. She doesn't want anything to do with feminism. But through her power, I think you called it intimate power, she ends up having enormous influence. It's a different kind of woman's influence, if you will.
Her power is the fact that she is quite literally the only person in the world to whom Ronald Reagan is truly close. And starting in Sacramento, she begins to get much more sophisticated about her own influence, her own power, and really her own role in his success.
Remarkable book about Nancy Reagan, the triumph of Nancy Reagan. Karen Tumulty, thank you so much.
Thank you, Judy.
Tonight's brief but spectacular comes from Eric Liu, who worked in the Bill Clinton White House. Liu offers his take on why he's still hopeful democracy can work for everyone. His latest book is called Become America.
I think people have a misconception that democracy is about voting. Absolutely. Show up, cast your ballot, pay attention to what happens after the casting of ballots. But I think the deeper thing is, how do you exercise the full breadth of your power every other day? All I had done was to have the dumb luck to be born here. My parents had done the heavy lifting. They had made the choice, the sacrifice to come to the United States and start this new life. And so the question always in the air was, how could I be useful? I remember very vividly when they became naturalized U.S. citizens in like 1977. They joined things. They showed up for things. They became members and leaders of the Mid-Hudson Chinese Community Association. They understood that to live in the society is not just to retreat to your tiniest bubble, but to try to be part of something greater than yourself. I think one of the best ways to teach children about civic engagement is just to weave it into a mindful approach to everyday life. Let's walk around our neighborhood and let's ask questions about what we see. Do you notice that there doesn't seem to be a bus stop where we live? Do you notice that there's only fast food stores in this neighborhood? Nothing healthy. All the streets are well paved and the sidewalks are nice, but once you cross this block, everything's kind of falling apart. Everything we see is the external deposit of a whole bunch of internalized choices about power, about responsibility, and about what we are supposed to do to create a healthy, thriving community. We're a country bound together by nothing but a creed. And when you have only a creed to hold you together, you've got to be able routinely, regularly, as a matter of ritual, to reckon with that creed and to ask, how am I going to close the gap between that creed and our deeds? Look at the way we actually police brown and black people. Look at the ways in which we actually educate children. Look at the ways in which we do or don't invest in public health. And ask, how can I show up to close that gap? We're having this conversation in the aftermath of the presidential election. And how I feel right now is determined. It's actually not the long game, but rather the deep game. The game beneath the visible game of partisan politics and vote counting and the jockeying for control of the Senate or what have you. There's a deeper game of our values. There's a deeper game of our willingness to take responsibility. Are we willing to humanize each other across partisan and other lines of difference? And that doesn't mean agreeing with the people we disagree with. It just means understanding, how did you come to this worldview? What pain, what hope, what trauma, what triumph led you to see the world this way? And how, in hearing that story, might I find some avenue in to say, okay, I get that. It doesn't take 300 million of us to suddenly decide we want to live like citizens this way. Majority rule is always driven by minority will. A critical mass of us, a small number of us, who are willing to show up over and over again to rekindle belief that this democracy can work for all of us, that's all it takes. I see a great civic awakening happening, especially among young people, but across the ideological spectrum and across the geography of our country, and that gives me hope. My name is Eric Liu, and this is my brief but spectacular take on living like a citizen.
Provocative. Something to think about. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.